Hey everyone, this is Free Food for Thought, a student-run, student-focused podcast here to feed your curiosity. I'm Emma.
And I'm Nathaniel, and today we're sitting down with Professor Richard Sander. Professor Sander has been a professor of law at the University of California, Los Angeles since 1989. He's a prominent scholar in the fields of affirmative action, employment discrimination, and housing policy. He received his undergraduate degree from Harvard University and his master's, law degree, and doctorate from Northwestern University. Prior to joining the faculty at UCLA, Sander practiced law and worked as an economist. He's best known for his research on the negative effects of affirmative action policies on minority students' academic performance, which has generated significant debate and discussion within the legal and academic communities. Professor Sander, thank you so much for joining us. It's a pleasure to have you here today.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with your upbringing. Where did you grow up, and how did your upbringing influence your path up to this point?
Well, I mostly grew up in Northwest Indiana. Lake County, Indiana is sort of a suburb of Chicago, but the area I grew up in was pretty rural. And it was entirely white. And growing up, I sort of observed the civil rights movement happening. I was very interested in public policy, but I didn't really have any direct experience. So after college, I became a VISTA volunteer. VISTA was sort of known as the Domestic Peace Corps, and it was a predecessor of AmeriCorps that we have today. And I started working on the south side of Chicago. So I had several years of adventures in different parts of community life in Chicago. I was doing this just before Barack Obama started his career as a community organizer in Chicago. And we overlapped with a lot of organizations and so on. Anyway, that gave me a wealth of experience, and a lot of what I've been doing since then is trying to sort of study issues and questions that came up during those years.
And do you have any stories from your time working with VISTA that you'd be able to share?
Well, yeah. One of the most valuable things that we did is trying to rescue buildings that were on the verge of abandonment. So my work in VISTA was in a neighborhood called South Shore. South Shore had been a mostly white, mostly Jewish community in the 1950s. In the 60s and 70s, it went through racial change. And like a lot of other neighborhoods in Chicago, racial change was accompanied by disinvestment, some increase in crime, and sort of a general increase in neighborhood instability. And the problem that was happening is that many neighborhoods, after going through racial transition, were having their multifamily sectors in particular sort of collapse. Housing would become abandoned. And so you would end up, you know, having a lot of housing just destroyed and lost. One thing we did as community folks, community organizers in South Shore, is we organized tenant unions to go to court and ask courts to appoint us as receivers so that we could basically collect money directly from the tenants and keep the utilities on, keep the buildings from being shut down. If utilities shut off gas in a building, for example, often the pipes would burst and then you'd kind of have you'd be beyond the point of recovery. But the group that was most interesting in this area was a bank that had been purchased by a group of foundations and churches. And they bought a conventional commercial bank that was in South Shore that had gotten sort of freaked out by the change happening and had tried to move downtown. And when federal regulators wouldn't let them move, they sold at a pretty low price to these investors. And the investors were basically sort of running it as a for-profit with nonprofit aspirations. And they developed strategies to try to coordinate investment and structure loans so that they were essentially trying to harmonize incentives to keep the neighborhood on track. And this was remarkably successful. They managed to lower the abandonment rate by something like 80 or 90% over a 5-year period. And South Shore stabilized, lost very little housing, and it's a pretty thriving neighborhood today.
In 2004, you published a study of affirmative action in American law school proposing the mismatch theory. Can you tell us more about your findings and what led you to this topic?
Sure. So I joined the law school, as you mentioned, in 1989. And one of the first projects I got involved in was trying to evaluate our academic support programs. We had started programs in the 80s to try to help students who were struggling in their first year of law school. And we had a bunch of different programs. And so we decided to try to figure out how to compare them empirically. Well, in the course of developing data to do that, I noticed that we had a dramatic drop-off. We had an average bar passage rate of about 88% or so. But we had some cohorts of admitted students who had bar passage rates below 50%. And so I thought, well, I wonder how those students would have done if they had gone to a less competitive school. Were they kind of disadvantaged by being at a school like UCLA where the professors were sort of teaching, pitching things at a fairly complicated or high level? I knew that there were schools that were much less competitive that had pretty decent bar passage rates. So logically, it just seemed like there must be something going on. It wasn't until the early 2000s, though, that I was able to get some data that allowed me to compare different schools. And that suggested that, yeah, in fact, most of this gap was really due not to students not having the ability to pass the bar, but going to a school where they weren't going to learn as much because of the level at which the courses were being taught. The implication of all of this was that if you looked at admissions preferences in law school, those mostly correlated with race, and the bar passage gap was particularly severe between blacks and whites. And so my article looked systemically across the whole legal education system, and I found that we could dramatically increase the number of black lawyers who were actually becoming black lawyers if we stopped using such large preferences. So that was a very counterintuitive idea and generated a lot of pushback.
And so what type of pushback was there?
Well, that's the interesting part. So I got into this thinking that the really big problem I was trying to solve was, schools using counterproductive policies. And my assumption was that, well, once we reveal this, it's sort of going to create a scandal and everyone's going to focus on it and they're going to insist that there be more transparency and that we get to the bottom of what's really going on. But it turned out there was a bigger story, which was the inability of academia to really deal in honest and transparent ways about matters dealing with race. In other words, I had touched such a raw nerve that that a lot of the institutions in legal education denounced the research. A lot of people who agreed with me and who sent me emails saying, well, this is completely compelling, were afraid that they would sort of be touching the third rail if they entered the debate. And so the only folks who sort of participated scholarly were people who were essentially ideologues defending affirmative action and making criticisms that weren't valid, that were, you know, usually cooking numbers, but sort of provided a cover for institutions to say, well, you see, it's been rebutted. So for years, and really to the present day, I don't spend all my time on affirmative action, but the 20 or 30% that I do spend on that has really been devoted to trying to point out that these critiques are fallacious and that when you get better data, the picture looks even more compelling than it did before.
Another issue regarding college admission is legacy admission. What's your opinion on legacy admission?
Legacy admissions are also a potential source of mismatch. So, you know, mismatch is not a racial thing. It purely has to do with the size of preferences. So if you give a large preference to someone based on a legacy status, that's going to harm them academically as much as doing it based on race. Again, the challenge is sort of finding good data and finding institutions willing to be transparent enough to study that data. there was a guy at Princeton named Tom Espenshod, who was very sympathetic to affirmative action, but he was able to get access to pretty good data on the Ivy League. And his research indicated that the average legacy preference was about a quarter the size of racial preferences for African Americans. Well, at that level, the mismatch isn't going to be too severe. The legacy preference may not be justified, but it's not going to have as harmful an academic effect. But since Espenshod wrote, which was about 20 years ago, legacy preferences have gotten bigger. And in the Harvard litigation, Harvard was forced to disclose a lot of its internal information. And the key expert for the plaintiffs who brought that suit has published work showing that legacy preferences at Harvard have gotten steadily larger over the last 20 years. So many legacies do run into the same mismatch issue that that we have with racial preferences or athletic preferences. So the upshot is that legacy preferences, I think, have become problematic and they've become excessive. And I think they're a good thing to curtail.
What do you think accounts for this shift or this change? Why do you think that the legacy admission has grown rapidly in recent years?
So what happened at Harvard is that Harvard had sort of had a commitment to, through their alumni boards and so on, to basically say every class will be 25 to 30% legacies. That's sort of our commitment to our graduates. What happened over the last 20 years is that the number of applicants Harvard receives every year has gone up by a factor of about 3. And that's probably why you guys found the environment very competitive when you applied. There were Harvard now admits something like 5% of its applicants. And that's happened generally. I mean, UCLA now gets 130,000 applicants a year, something like that. It's kind of crazy. So you have many more applicants. You also have a more aggressive use of diversity measures at Harvard than you did before. So that means that the competition for those for the non-legacy spots is and the non-diversity spots is producing people with really, really high credentials. So the legacies are probably about as academically prepared as they were 20 years ago, but they're now competing with students who are really, really have fearsome scores and high school records. So that's increased the disparity. Now, one other thing on the legacy issue that's kind of interesting. There's a guy named Alan Morrison. He's a law professor at, I think he's in George Washington. And he's an old liberal. He worked with Ralph Nader to develop Public Citizen back in the late 60s and 1970s. And he's very unhappy with legacy preferences. And he pointed out that there's a good argument against Harvard's use of racial preferences, which is that legally, under current Supreme Court doctrine, schools are supposed to narrowly tailor their use of racial preferences. In other words, they're supposed to do things that don't require them to take race into account to increase diversity before they resort to racial preferences. And he pointed out that if Harvard got rid of legacies, for example, they would have a more diverse class. So he wrote this up in a brief, and then he started getting some pushback, and he needed to find somebody who would sort of be the signatory to the brief. He was the lawyer preparing it. He needed a signatory. And he reached out to me, and I sort of looked around and asked various folks. And some of the conservatives didn't want to sign a brief written by Alan Morrison. And some of the liberals said, no, we don't want to sign that because we want Harvard to win this lawsuit. So guess who eventually became the signatory in the brief? My wife. My wife is a dean at Caltech. And Caltech is one of the schools that doesn't use legacy preferences. So she was willing. Alan thought it'd be great. And so my wife is on the brief that probably got the most attention last year when the briefs were filed.
And so what do you think the judicial system's responsibility really is in deciding these outcomes?
Well, there are two different sort of legal issues that are raised by Harvard and UNC's use of racial preferences. There's the 14th Amendment, which was passed after the Civil War, and was basically designed to prevent states from having black codes. There were almost all the South and many northern states in 1865 had essentially different legal systems for blacks and whites. The 14th Amendment said, no, you have to have the same laws applying to everyone. And that equal protection clause has been held to prohibit most forms of governmental racial discrimination. The question is, does that apply to things like racial preferences used by UNC? I think it's a close question. But the other sort of legal basis comes from the 1964 Civil Rights Act. And the 64 Civil Rights Act was, of course, passed much more recently. And people were aware of affirmative action at the time. And the issue of preferences was debated in Congress when they passed the 64 Act. So Title VI of the 64 Act prohibits racial discrimination. And there are many people in Congress who said at the time, we don't want this to lead to reverse discrimination. So I think the case for courts enforcing Title VI is much stronger. And Title VI applies to Harvard as well as UNC because it applies to any institution that receives government money. And Harvard, probably 20 or 30% of Harvard's budget comes from government grants of various kinds.
Here at Claremont McKenna, we have a lot of students aspiring to continue their education after college, whether it is law school or graduate school. Can you give some advice on whether it is necessary to obtain these diplomas as a professor for law in UCLA?
In other words, should I encourage more lawyers? I think that there's from a social point of view, there's plenty of talent going to law school. If one was thinking, how best can I use my talents for society, I'm not sure that going to law school is necessarily the way to do it. We have a lot of people come to law school because they want to engage in social reform of various kinds. But I think something we've learned over the last 30 years is that it's often hard to really affect positive change through litigation. You can fix some abuses, but to actually really make society work better, you kind of have to work within institutions and develop institutions that are going to actually deliver well. So something that I've always felt would be nice is if we had graduate schools that sort of helped one to learn about institution building. I mentioned before this bank in South Shore. That was a really creative idea, and it had a dramatic impact. With a very small investment, they had many, many times their initial investments impact and a very positive effect on the community. So we need more people to sort of learn about institution building, which involves some things from law and some things from business and some things from economics and probably some things from engineering. And we don't really have schools that kind of teach that institution building skill. So that's not maybe the ideal answer to your question, but that's sort of a reaction.
I think given that we're in California right now and the homelessness crisis is just quite large here, how do you think either local, state, or federal government should approach the housing crisis in America?
So I'll comment on two different things. One is the area of fair housing. So in 1968, we passed a Fair Housing Act. That was part of the Civil Rights Revolution. And the Fair Housing Act was motivated by two things. One was combating housing discrimination, and the other was trying to foster housing integration. So discrimination is how you're treated when you apply for housing. Integration is whether people actually live together in the same kind of community. Well, over the last 50 years, I think we've largely solved the problem of housing discrimination. When we do large-scale testing, we find that it's quite rare now. Not extinct, but not really a major problem now. But housing segregation is still quite severe. And something exciting is happening right now. The Department of Housing and Urban Development in Washington is developing regulations that are going to require cities that receive federal grants to develop integration strategies. It's sort of weak. It's sort of a baby step, but it's a step in the right direction. And I'm actually, working on comments right now on the proposed regulations. It's an issue that I'm even more passionate about than affirmative action. And I think there's some rays of hope there. The other issue is affordability. if you compare again today with 50 years ago, we've done a great job of getting rid of a lot of slum housing. So the average quality of housing units is much, much higher today than it was in 1970. You know, complete plumbing facilities are widespread. Rats have been in retreat. There's less housing overcrowding. Housing is just generally in much better shape. Only about a third as many people die from house fires as they did 50 years ago. But part of the cost of that has been a reduction in housing affordability. Housing's become significantly more expensive. Now, we can make housing less expensive. We have the technology to produce housing less expensively than we did. But we have a great many regulations, especially in California, that inhibit housing production. So we need to figure out ways of loosening those regulations and really trying to focus on building more housing. If we increase the housing stock by even 10%, that would have a dramatic impact not only on homelessness, but on actual housing price levels. And that seems to me, you know, I think there's general agreement that that's a critical area for intervention.
We have just enough time for one more question. Could you tell us about a book, a song, or an academic article that has been on your mind recently?
Well, I'll tell you about a book that I really like. It's by Steven Pinker, and it's called...
He was on the podcast as well.
Really? Yeah. Oh, great. Mm-hmm. Good old Steve. Well, I don't know if he talked about this, but he wrote a book called, I think, The Better Angels of Our Nature, and it's a history of violence. And what Pinker was showing is that if you look over the broad sweep of history, or even if you look at recent decades, violence has generally been in retreat. Murder rates have gone down. Almost any type of crime that you look at is much lower now than it used to be. And it's a reason for optimism. It's also a reason to realize that a lot of our day-to-day media coverage tends to focus on catastrophes and problems. But we've actually shown an ability to sort of increase our empathy, increase our successful mechanisms for dealing with social problems. So Pinker is an optimist. And over the long term, I tend to be an optimist too. I think that a lot of problems that really worry us now, say global warming, for example, are problems that, you know, if we take seriously but don't panic about, we can solve.
Well, thank you so much for your time, Professor Sander. And to all of our listeners, remember to stay hungry.